I'm Colleen Cosmo Murphy, founder of Classic Album Sundays. We tell the stories behind the albums that have changed our lives through our worldwide immersive listening events and our website, which hosts artist interview videos, playlists, and blogs about our favorite albums. This podcast features my conversation with composer Max Richter and conductor André de Ridder about the album recomposed by Max Richter, Vivaldi, The Four Seasons. The album, which takes some of the practices of electronic and new music and marries it with classical music, topped the iTunes classical charts when it was released. The interview is from a Classic Album Sundays event held at London's Shoreditch Church as part of the Spitalfields Music Festival. Once you have listened to the podcast, I encourage you to listen to the entire album following our listening guidelines, and in this way, you can have your own Classic Album Sundays at home.
I was telling you earlier, I'm not the biggest, I'm not very knowledgeable about classical music, but I am with Vivaldi, The Four Seasons. It's one of the albums I've had, pieces that I've had since I was in high school when I worked in a record shop. How did you become aware of Vivaldi, The Four Seasons? What were your, what was your initial relationship with it? I'm asking each of you this.
Well, I guess, like many people, it's really the first piece of, you know, inverted commas, classical music I ever got familiar with. As a child, I encountered this. It was a record, sort of my parents had a few classical records, and I sort of play this music and fall in love with it, basically. The thing about the Vivaldi is that it's, as well as being very bold and daring and clever music, it's really charming. You know, it's got beautiful tunes, the sections aren't too long, so for a kid they're, you know, perfect. So yeah, you know, as a little child, I fell in love with this material.
How about you, André?
I grew up learning the violin, so my first instrument is violin, and of course then you get familiar with that piece very, very early on. But for me, it was always, I think I remember the first time I heard it live was on television, and it was when in Berlin, the chamber music hall of the Berlin Philharmonie was opened, and Karajan was still alive. So it's this beautiful building, sister building to the big Philharmonie, which Hans Scherun designed. And they, I don't know when it was, mid-80s, they opened it. And Karajan was conducting with the Berlin Phil, and Anne-Sophie Mutter was playing. Karajan was already almost 80 years old, I think, and so it was a very old-fashioned version of this piece, and I really, really, really didn't appreciate it. And of course, for me, it also stood for, you know, it's kind of a sort of the pop piece of classical music, and it's been used in so many different ways other than what the actual music suggests. And then I actually only really got to appreciate Vivaldi on the whole. I thought he'd only written that one piece, basically. And then when I started learning the Baroque violin, actually, which I did in my later teens, then I discovered the beauty of that piece, and, you know, in period performances, but also the vast work of Vivaldi, other pieces, other concertos, and I really got to appreciate that it is probably his best piece, and it still, for me, ranks as one of the greatest pieces of classical music, and for me, it's difficult to imagine how he wrote it, how he came to write it. And working with Max on this particular project, actually, 5 years ago, that, and going back to the original score together with Max, and then on his new score, that really made me understand the greatness of the work.
You mentioned before that it was almost like a pop piece of classical music, but when he wrote it nearly 400 years ago, it was quite revolutionary.
Yes.
Because he was musically and instrumentally depicting the sounds of nature and the sounds of humans.
Yes. That's right. It's storytelling music, really. I mean, there are texts which are, you know, maybe by him, maybe not by him. But even aside from the text aspect, you know, it tells stories, it paints pictures. And it's a very early example of music trying to do that. So, I mean, it's very bold, clever music which appears simple, which I think is a wonderful thing.
So why did you decide to tackle Vivaldi, The Four Seasons?
Well, for me, as I said, as a little child, you know, I fell in love with this very beautiful, charming music. And then, you know, later on, I sort of became aware of just hearing it the whole time, you know, on TV and advertising and jingles. And it kind of drove me crazy. And I became basically kind of unable to hear it as music. I was just hearing this irritating kind of jingle. And so I had this kind of schism of, on the one hand, knowing it to be sort of very bold, thoughtful, beautifully made music, and on the other hand, hating it. So really, for me, the Recompose project was a sort of an act of trying to like reclaim it and trying to explore it as a musical object and trying to sort of rediscover what I loved about it in the first place by just sort of examining what was there.
Was there also an aim to maybe bring it to the 21st century?
Well, we live in the 21st century, so I guess that was inevitable. But, you know, I didn't set out to kind of modernize the work. I mean, actually, it's a very, in some ways, a very modern work. Because the way Vivaldi's music is constructed, you know, it connects very much to sort of pattern-based musics that come from sort of dance music and electronic music and post-minimal music. You know, there is a sort of a kinship there, so it has a sort of modernity. But really what I wanted to do, in a way, if we think of the original Four Seasons, Vivaldi's work as a kind of a landscape, I wanted to try and sort of go off-road through that landscape and sort of find new things in it.
Actually, maybe it's interesting to say the story of how it came into being, because it was part of this Deutsche Grammophon Recompose series that they started maybe 10 years prior to that, and they had gone to, over the years, to several mostly electronic musicians or even DJs to ask to remix pieces from the classical catalog and classic, not just classical, but classic recordings of Deutsche Grammophon, you know, amongst them Matthew Herbert, Jimmy Tenor, there's also Moritz von Oswald, these people. So they all went and listened to all the great recordings on Deutsche Grammophon, and then they went into the studio and made basically electronic remixes of it. And I think originally they approached Max with a similar idea, is that right? But you actually decided to do something else then in the end.
Yes, I mean the brief in a way was we would like to, you know, have the next in this Recomposed series, and will you, you know, what would you remix something for us? So then I kind of sat on this idea. Yes, well I'll do something with the Four Seasons, and then I thought about it for about 10 seconds and realized then I really couldn't do what I wanted to do from a technical standpoint by remixing. It would basically be impossible. But in some ways what I did is I made a kind of analog remix, in that I used really all those processes that we use in the studio, you know, time stretching and compression and reversing and filtering. I did all those things on paper with the notes. So it is a kind of a remix, but it's an analog remix.
That's what I find. So, what I appreciate about this project is that what Max just described, and that it's the first in a series that actually using remix techniques, but actually writing them out. And that is very 21st century about it. When you're saying bringing it into the 21st century, just using the techniques of looping and remixing, but actually writing it out like a proper composer would. So that's what, you know, I appreciate about it. Thank you.
So how true to the original did you want to stay to it? I mean, how did you want to, do you feel it kept the soul of the original?
Well, I wanted to make a project which retained the spirit of Vivaldi. I didn't want to make a kind of a modernist intervention and sort of deconstruct it. I wanted something which had the sort of directness that Vivaldi's music has, which I think is one of the great strengths of it, actually. You know, it's very immediate. So that was my sort of guiding principle, yeah.
And when you just, how did you feel when Andre helped realize this when you were in the studio recording it, and Daniel Hope? Do you feel they were able to help really realize what you had envisioned in the studio and when you were writing?
Yeah, of course. I mean, what really the score of any work is a kind of proposition. You know, it's obviously a set of instructions, and, you know, the notes are the notes. But really, that's the starting point for a sort of creative journey, a conversation. And the collaborators in a project like this, you know, Andre and Daniel, you know, you're dealing with very skilled, experienced musicians who have a lifetime of, you know, making music. And part of, you know, realizing a piece for the first time is a sort of problem-solving thing. You know, you're sort of, you're feeling your way towards this object which is kind of out there, you know, and obviously, you know, all sorts of musical experiences that people have feed into that.
What kind of problems were there? When you say problem solving,
problems are not kind of what, you know, to do what you remember, what the original piece was. There's some sort of traps. There's some sort of movements where Max did, for a while at least, almost what Vivaldi did, then put some spanners in the work, an extra beat or so. And I mean, actually, it was more a problem for Daniel because he'd actually performed the work, obviously, in its original form many times. And for him, it was. He really had to relearn this completely. I hadn't performed it or conducted it very much because it's not really supposed to be conducted in the first place. I mean, the original Vivaldi. And so for me, I mean, we actually did a lot of work. I mean, it's nice because it wasn't a project where I was given the finished score and then turn up and record it, but we met in Max's studio a few times as he was composing it and listening, you know, thinking about it, looking at the original score quite a lot. So there was a lot of exchange, and so on that immediately we had a different starting point when we started recording.
Was it daunting to tackle a piece like this, one that is so revered and so well loved by millions and millions of people?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, when you're starting out on a project, I find it's best not to think about results, you know? I just sort of follow the material. But in this case, I mean, I think going back to your earlier point about, you know, how much of it was Vivaldi and how sort of retaining what Vivaldi wrote. I mean, that was in a way the most sort of tricky problem because trying to figure out at any moment, you know, how much of what I was doing was Vivaldi and how much was me, because that was really quite challenging. And I guess the score on the page ended up being almost all not Vivaldi, but it feels like Vivaldi.
So you think it's sympathetic?
Well, I hope it is. I mean, I don't, you know, it's not like sort of drawing a mustache on the Mona Lisa at all. So I didn't want to vandalize it, you know. I wanted to do something which basically let me sort of encounter it anew, you know, for the first time.
Yeah, I actually find it, even though it's so different in places, I find it extremely true to the original, and just spinning it forth, I mean, again, talking about maybe 21st century, blah, blah, but there is an element of that. Maybe some things that get stuck in your mind about the piece, and you have like an earworm, and Max sometimes took that and just spun it forth, or gave it an extra edge, or a sort of, and then sticks with that for a while. And that's what's fascinating. That's also why it's so successful, I think.
There are some detractors who may say Vivaldi The Four Seasons is perfect already. It does not need to be recomposed. What do you say to those detractors?
Well, I don't disagree with that. I mean, for me, it wasn't an attempt to replace the original. What I was trying to do was to try and get myself personally into a situation where I could fall in love with the original again, so it's a sort of act of exorcism, really, of sort of all these jingles, trying to get rid of that and trying to reconnect to Vivaldi's.
I actually think that argument is completely hollow, because over the centuries, composers like Bach, Handel, Schumann, and so on have always composed music about other music, or the principle of, I mean, think of Benjamin Britten doing The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. It's nothing else but writing variations over this Purcell theme. Mm. And in a way, the principle of variation is one of the most important devices in music. And in a way, you could look at this piece not as a remix, but as a variation on a theme by Vivaldi. So it's completely legit.
I mean, this idea of music, whatever else music is about, it's also about previous music, other music. All guitar bands kind of go back to the Kinks or the Beatles, and every other sort of music also has this sort of iterative process where, the reason we do music is because we love music, so we connect to previous music. It's completely, it's an inevitable part of it, I think.
And it's been so inspirational as a piece to so many musicians and composers like Bach, to a band called the Baronics that did a surf guitar cover version of it. So do you think that your recomposed gives us a new understanding of the Four Seasons?
Wow. I guess, in a way, one of the processes I feel, it sort of feels like, is that, I'm sort of digging, I'm sort of mining the Four Seasons in the recomposition. I'm sort of trying to get inside the material. And I think partly because the piece is so well known, I think when you hear it, there's a sort of feeling of us sort of going on that trip into the material together. And I think you wouldn't have that experience with material that wasn't so well known. Because in a way, we all know how it's sort of meant to go. And then when I sort of take a different route through some material, I think that's part of the interest, actually. It's like, I know how it's meant to go, and now we're going over here,
How about you, Andre?
Well, I think actually some of the technique, sort of in every piece, Max uses a sort of different technique, how to approach the piece or how to remix it. And some of them are like an analysis of like one pattern, and then he sort of exercises it through, and then maybe we realize something about it that we didn't realize before, like how modern it is, for example. And that it sounds completely modern, but it still is actually original Vivaldi. It's just a sequence taken a bit further, or actually sort of almost driven to ad nauseam, like an extended, a 12-inch remix of a great song. And then I think that makes us realize, well, actually, yeah, that's it's quite a modern technique, but actually Vivaldi did that. Or Vivaldi used these little particles, like maybe a piece of minimal music, pattern work would actually do, and he sort of did that already.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I've sometimes felt when sort of engaging with the original score is, if we're going to go there, then let's go there, I think sometimes you can feel Vivaldi sort of pushing against the language of his time, that it actually has got a sort of motoric sort of pulsing, minimal sort of DNA inside it, but somehow the language of that time obviously didn't allow that sort of directness.
Classical music has such a wide definition. I mean, it can be so many things, from the chanting of medieval monks to romantic symphonies to avant-garde atonal pieces by 20th century composers. What should classical music sound like in the 21st century? It's a difficult one. Come on, Andre.
Well, I don't know. I say classical music should sound alive, and it should move people the same as in any other music or any other century. So, but that's why I also, you know, I believe in the classical masterpieces, but I also believe in the necessity of writing new music, of hearing live music by living composers all the time, and the dialogue between them. I mean, this is what this festival is about a lot. Is about, and you know, it's not always so much to ask what's new and what's something. Do we produce something that has not been said before? But it can be said in other ways, and it can maybe be said in ways that are more contemporary or more contemporary understandable, and therefore why not using modern media. I mean, things like electronics, for example, or synthesizers can be just, you know, they're just instruments, just like orchestra instrument. Electronics and electronic analysis and synthesis is just another instrument, so but it's a modern sort of appearance, and adding that to the palette, you know, is a, for me, also a legitimate thing that can develop things or push things into a new direction or break through a new sound barrier. And you know, this is what new music should be about. And, you know, otherwise I'm just as fond of the classics of music by from Monteverdi, Vivaldi, Beethoven, Mozart. And, you know, maybe the interpretation of these pieces can change, you know, can pick up something in 2017 that maybe people wouldn't have picked up in 1950, because it was a different world. And so I think what live music should be about should be that it should be in the today. And this is not just about the music written today, but also about the music that was written in the 15th century, if it still moves us, if there's something about it that still speaks to us today.
How about you, Max?
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with Andre. I mean, most, I think a lot of the sort of challenges around classical music are mostly to do with language and the way the music is sort of constructed within the society. I mean, at base level, you know, music is human beings making sounds in time. And there's something, you know, innately sort of free about that. But actually it has all these sort of social constructs around it. And, you know, ways of relating to it. And, you know, music languages have lots of kind of shoulds in them. And I personally am sort of very allergic to that sort of categorization and that way of thinking about, you know, sound making. Because sound making is a way of talking. And actually, it's inherently a very sort of democratic open space. And that's not to discount, you know, the classical canon, because, you know, some of that material is, you know, amongst them, you know, the most wonderful sort of cultural projects of humanity. You know, it is. It's incredibly rich, and it's something, you know, equally accessible to all. Once you take away those sorts of social frameworks, but I'm sort of very optimistic, really, about a kind of plural music culture which has evolved over the last decades. You know, where you've got sort of music cultures interpenetrating and talking to one another. So yeah, I'm excited to see what comes next.
So I guess it's breaking down those structures, and things like the kind of symphonic retrospectives of Detroit techno producers like Carl Craig or Jeff Mills, the artists on erased tapes like Niels Fromm, let's see, who else, there's loads of Alarm Will Sound, High Plains. These are all musicians that are really breaking down boundaries and really blurring the lines between electronic music, minimalist music, classical music. So do you see this as something like a natural evolution for classical music, as it has been so many things? In certain ways, it's had its rigid structures, but at the same time, it has evolved.
Yeah.
Just so much.
I mean, I just feel it's really natural for creative people to want to sort of push beyond categories. Mm. I don't think ideas, you know, naturally live inside boxes. Mm. You know, I think we're that's not what it's about, you know. It's about connecting directly and sort of real-time experience and conversation. And I also think, you know, as Andre was saying, you know, schooled composers now very naturally reach for electronic media and computers and synthesis. Absolutely. I mean, on a level of complete equivalence with orchestral instrumentation, or, you know, it's quite natural, I think.
I mean, I've through working in these different projects, I've really learned that, you know, good pop music that's well made and that's not been written down before by a composer, because that's normally how you could define maybe classical music. I mean, playing a piano doesn't necessarily mean that it's classical music, for example. But, you know, you would, you know, and usually the definition is, okay, somebody's composed a score and that. But, you know, I've really learned that there's so much great pop music and electronic music out there that is, a 100 times more complex than some pieces of classical music. So, and there was always this sort of evaluation of classical and pop, like, especially in Germany, we have this E and U music. One is entertainment music and one is serious music. And the serious music is the classical music. And this categorization, you know, is a sort of a value thing as well, cultural value. And that's really just, you know, I've worked with pop musicians who've worked on three minutes of music for a year, you know, and the complexities of it, and just hitting that right sound, and they're obsessed with the right sound, and it's just different. They're writing in sound, whereas classical composers write normally on. But that doesn't mean one or the other thing is better, or even more complex, or less complex, or more simple. And so, you know, and once you realize that, and also that changes your ears. It changed my ears too, because these musicians, who are not necessarily classically trained, their ears are incredible, and sometimes more taxing than the musician of a classic, or the ears of a classical musician. And, you know, this sort of opened, for me anyway, a whole range of new experiences.
I've heard that kind of differentiation being called high art and low art before as well.
It's the same thing.
Sounds a bit snobby, doesn't it?
Yeah, right.
But what can these disciplines learn from one another? What can popular music learn from classical and vice versa?
I mean, that's a tough one. I mean, what I'd say is I you know, as going back to, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I really was sort of disappointed to discover that those categories existed, you know, because the thing that transported me was, you know, interesting sounds which kind of made sense and sounds which told a story. And it seemed to me a great sort of shame that some of those sounds were, you know, better than others simply because of the way that they were described in the society, which I thought was false. So, you know, I guess a lot of my work has been about sort of trying to explore a kind of a boundary zone, you know, where these two worlds can kind of live together.
I've always thought there's two kinds of music, good music and bad music. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but how about you, Andre? What do you think these two worlds can learn from one another, popular music and classical music?
Well, as I can sort of speak from my experience as a musician who grew up as classically trained or in a classical household even, what incredible work and dedication goes into the production of electronic music and pop music and folk music, and what incredible knowledge and and time these performers and composers spend with it. Whereas actually in the classical music world, it's very often now the case that people, like orchestras for example, 1 week after another, different program, even 2 days rehearsals program, 2 days rehearsals program, soloists, travel around the world, conductors do the same thing, and it's just like, you know, obviously they play other people's music most of the time, whereas the difference is that in pop music or folk music, electronic music, the performers are also the composers. So this is an interesting difference. So it's difficult, therefore, to completely compare the two. It really, there are, and for that reason, often different worlds. But you know, I learned a lot from that. What I learned is basically try and spend like once in a while 3 months on just one piece of music. You know, we really immerse yourself in it and the performance of it, or creating a new project, take yourself out of that rat race, and you go back to the drawing board. Really, that's what I learned from it.
I wanted to talk about the Spitalfields Music Festival, Winter Music Festival, and a few of the things that you're doing here, which is about mashups, especially the one that you're doing in a couple days with Mark Titchener. Can you tell us about that? It's about Fugazi and Monteverdi.
That one. I mean, you know what? I believe less in that, in the idea of mashups, and I said this many times, but actually in presenting things in an equal setting, maybe comparing things, and because of this value thing, to see things that they have similar value or different values that are not better or worse. So, you know, even when we, like in 2 days' time, there's one thing where we, with Stargaze, we play with two or even three composers from electronic musicians' background, like Nick Voigt from Factory Floor, or Daniel Brandt of Brandbrauer Frick, you know, who they're all, they in their bands, electronic or acoustic bands, they all make music that's very sort of, it's kind of minimal techno-oriented, which you would never equate with anything to do with classical music. But because of these elements that are in there, in the minimal techno, are also quite similar to what you would find in classical minimal music from the 20th century, you know, starting with, you know, the Reich Glass, and so on, Terry Riley elements, you know. And I think actually a lot of the technoid elements come from that music. And so there are some things that are quite close. And these people mostly work with machines, so, you know, laptop and synthesizers. And it's a fascinating process for them also to get live musicians back in a rehearsal room. And oftentimes that's also based sometimes on improvisation. So we as classical musicians, we have to get away sometimes from just reading the notes that are in front of us, but actually trying to just use our ears and play with our ears. And that's what we're trying to do in those particular projects, like that we're here on Wednesday. A lot of it will be improvised also by the so-called classical musicians, which has always been a learning process for us in Stargaze. And as far as the Fugazi project, that's kind of crazy. I met this wonderful visual artist, Mark Titchener, a Turner Prize nominee, who works a lot with words and sentences on these kind of banners and murals. So if you look around, actually, he's made an installation for our festival in this church. And they're inspired by the sort of banners that this Washington DC hardcore band, or post-hardcore band Fugazi, had in when they played these anti-war charity concerts, for example, in prisons or in front of the White House in 91. One of them was basically saying this, there will be two wars. And what we performed pieces by Claudio Monteverdi on Saturday, which are all, they were all taken from his book of Love and War. And they're poems about warfare, or often about love, but love fought out, so to speak, with a vocabulary of war. It's very ambivalent. And some of the banners that you'll see around, and you're very welcome to walk upstairs and see his artwork. And then he worked with young people and students to create their own banners from their favorite text of their favorite bands. And it's hard to tell which ones are of Monteverdi and which ones are of Fugazi. And that was the idea, to, you know, take these things out of context and see what they do to you. But it's the origin of them is not that clear anymore.
And I guess they have a lot more in common than we would normally think anyways. Things don't fit into nicely into neat little boxes, do they? All these lines are blurred. Well, before we listen to Max Richter recompose Vivaldi the Four Seasons, could you each share with us something we should listen out for?
Well, I mean, I guess maybe if you know the original, which probably you probably know it even if you don't think you know it, because it's kind of everywhere. I mean, I think there are sort of various kind of aha little moments. Not aha the band, but aha. things which sort of light up because they're really well known and they sort of pop out at you. And those are obviously things I had to kind of, you know, pay special attention to in the recomposition.
Andre?
To listen out for, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting how, there's these interludes that Max created, which are purely electronic, and it comes from that sort of electronic, almost from an ambience of electronic mist, and the interludes have this sort of function, but he's also sometimes, within the pieces themselves, created that sort of almost cosmic ambience that's somewhere there, but the original melody, like especially in the, which one is the slow movement where you just took the melody and the winter, you know, where you basically just changed the accompaniment, the solo line is still the same, but the way he scored the orchestral writing is basically making it sound like electronic music, even though it isn't, using extended techniques to make a sound that really makes us believe it's electronic music. So listen out for that. That's a especially beautiful moment.
I was just looking for the record. It's right there. Good. All right, well, thank you so much. Please give a big hand to Andre de Ridder and Max Richter.
A very big thank you to my special guests, Max Richter and Andre de Ridder, and to the staff at the Spitalfields Music Festival. If you enjoyed this, please subscribe to our weekly Classic Album Sundays podcasts via your favorite podcast provider. And keep your ears open for our next one, in which I interview the pianist Neil Cowley about the album Charlie Brown Christmas by Vince Guaraldi. If you would like to find out more about Classic Album Sundays, head over to our website, where you can find info on how to join as one of our Patreon members to attend our virtual online events, meetups, and streams. I'm Colleen Cosmo Murphy, and now I encourage you to have a listen to Recomposed by Max Richter, Vivaldi, The Four Seasons, following our listening guidelines. Turn off your phone, refrain from conversation, turn down the lights, turn up the volume, and then listen to the album all the way through without interruption. Thanks for listening.